Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. So let's start out with talking about something that's been very much in the news, in the science as well, but certainly a lot of buzz out there on the internet, and that's time-restricted eating. So it's a dietary regimen that restricts eating to specific hours, and it's been getting a lot of attention. There's a guy named Walter Longo who's written several books about it, and lots of people are talking about the benefits. This study is a mouse study. There's a couple lessons about science here, but the most important one that I want to bring to you is that it's not just for weight loss. Time-restricted eating studies are often done in young male rats. But in this study, rather than using just young male rats, they used rats of both sexes and both ages, young and old, to try to get a better sense for how it could work on degenerative type diseases, because just like humans, rats get diabetes, they get fatty liver disease, liver cancer. And in something I found really interesting in this study, they also looked at infectious diseases and found a benefit for time-restricted eating to that. What exactly are we talking about? Well, we're talking about limiting your eating, in this case, to 9 hours a day. And we have a society where there's always food around. And many people, particularly if the ones who are a bit insulin resistant or have that tendency, eat very, very frequently. The only period of time that they don't eat is when they're asleep, and they eat just before bed and they eat as soon as they wake up. So they aren't getting much time when there isn't food in their stomach. And when food's not in your stomach, a whole bunch of interesting things happen. Food itself is inflammatory, important. Your system sustains an inflammatory hit every time it eats, particularly if there happens to be any carbohydrate involved in that. But even if not, it's still going to be inflammatory for a while. So if your body is always getting a little bit inflamed because it's always having to deal with food, you can see how that would create a substantial issue when we're talking about something like the way a lot of Americans eat. The time-restricted eating, on the other hand, is a completely different story. During the time that you're not eating, your body has a chance to, well, clean out the trash, sweep up the floors, get rid of the garbage, and in fact, your body will start to assimilate and metabolize some of those broken down bits of protein, turn them back into energy because, hey, it's got nothing else kicking around to do, and it can use that fuel. So time-restricted eating is good for mice, but it's also good for humans. And 40% of Americans are either already diabetic or pre-diabetic. 40%, that's crazy, guys. We've got to do something about this. Turns out that time-restricted eating does do something about it. So going back to this particular study, researchers fed a high-fat, high-sugar diet to male and female mice of two different age groups, basically the equivalent to 20-year-olds and the equivalent to 42-year-olds. And they restricted the eating to 9 hours per day. And they looked at a bunch of health parameters, fatty liver disease, glucose regulation, muscle mass, performance, endurance, survival against sepsis. One of the real flaws of science that we do on rats and, of course, mice, we base a lot of what we think about humans on this, but mice are nocturnal. So if we take the mice and we jet lag them, essentially we put them in a brightly lit lab and we're messing with them. Mice are normally most active at night. So these researchers took the very rare step of matching their lab conditions to the animal's circadian clocks. So they worked via night vision goggles, and they kept the lighting in the lab during the working hours very low. Reminded me of a zoo I went to once where they had flipped the day-night cycles, and all the nocturnal animals were wandering around very active because it was their time of maximum activity, but they had flipped them so that it was corresponding to ours. It was very, very interesting. Anyway, regardless of age, whether they lost weight, the sex of the mice, time-limited or restricted eating strongly protected against fatty liver disease. The females who were on it did gain weight, but they had better blood sugar and less fatty livers. They also did oral glucose tolerance tests to the mice after 16 hours of fasting, and they found that the oral glucose tolerance test was better. The mice were more insulin sensitive, and they had a faster return to normal blood sugar levels. Also, the middle-aged males and the females were able to restore those normal blood sugars more efficiently than the control mice. The control mice could eat any time. So we should be using time-restricted eating to prevent prediabetes from moving into diabetes. There's solid data that this would work. The last thing that these researchers did that I found extremely interesting was they injected a toxin into the mice to create a sort of sepsis-like circumstance. They monitored survival rates for 2 weeks, and they found that the time-restricted eating schedule actually protected both the male and female mice of all the ages from getting as sick, from dying of sepsis. They also found that in the male mice, the time-restricted eating improved muscle performance, and they were able to add muscle mass. So for older individuals, where muscle mass and muscle performance are critical for preventing frailty, this is particularly significant. We have to study it more to understand what's going on. Why does the muscle mass increase? Is it because the muscles are able to repair themselves better because they have time off from having to store glucose? What's the impact? Are we releasing hormones that stimulate muscle development? Whenever you get something unexpected like this in science, it's always exciting because then you really get a chance. That's when you find the new things. That's when you find the new discoveries. When the unexpected is when science gets really exciting. I promised you a deep dive on this. So this week, we're going to discuss two articles about new medical research on the cannabinoids, their receptors, and the many ways that naturally occurring cannabinoids differ from plant-based compounds such as THC and CBD. Now that decriminalization and legislation are well underway, there is a flood of interesting research emerging demonstrating new and ever more fascinating ways that loops of internal feedback systems regulate the brain, the immune system, and the whole beautiful web of brain biology. We're going to be focusing on a specific subsystem, the cannabinoids, but first I need to remind you of how the basic connection between two or more neurons works. It's called the synapse. We'll start by visualizing a spider web. As you know, the spider sits in the web and feels all the tiny vibrations of the threads and is able to tell the difference between the wind, a raindrop, and the struggling fly caught in the web. Every neuron has a web of dendrites, tiny web-like arms spreading out in all directions around the nucleus. In our simplified model, these receive incoming info through surfaced receptors that recognize chemical signals. These signals are released by other neurons in order to send information. The signals are called neurotransmitters and include some familiar names: norepinephrine, also known as noradrenaline, and serotonin. Slowing down the breakdown of serotonin is the target of drugs like Prozac and other SSRIs. Each neuron has extending from its cell body a cable called the axon, reaching out and traveling to another location, sometimes a very far location. In the case of the sciatic nerve, the distance can be up to 36 inches. Spider sensors receive enough of a chemical signal on its receptors. It fires off a process that passes the signal along the axon to a distant location where the axon releases chemicals, neurotransmitters, that are picked up by the dendrites of another adjacent neuron. Sometimes those signals are stimulatory, leading to the release of another axon impulse on down the line. Sometimes they are inhibitory, making it less likely that the receiving cell will transmit the message. Depending on the receptor present on the dendrites in question, the same neurotransmitter can act as a brake or as an accelerator. But wait, there's more. And this is where it gets really, really intricate and beautiful. What if I send an inhibitory signal to a neuron that's releasing inhibitory signals from its axon? Well, then I've created a double negative, effectively inhibiting the release or the brake of an existing inhibitor. It's the same as giving the stimulation signal. If I apply a brake to the cell that is pushing on the brake in the first place, it's the same thing as pressing down on the accelerator. This creates a damping down effect that keeps things from spiraling out of control. In a few moments, we'll start with our first story, which talks about epileptic seizures, a classic example of neurons spiraling out of control. But before that, we need to spend a little time talking about those receptors. There are two main receptors for the cannabinoids, CB1 and CB2. CB1 is found mainly on neurons. CB2 is found mainly on the immune system, and that includes the inflammatory cells in the brain, something that turns out to be fairly important when we start talking about inflammatory neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease. It probably won't surprise you to learn that the highest concentrations of CB1 receptors in the brain are in the hippocampus, the seat of memory processing, the cortex, which is where we think our complex thoughts, and the cerebellum, which controls motor movement and coordination and balance. There are CB2 receptors in the brain as well, but as I said, they are primarily found in the microglia, the immune cells of the brain, that release things like tumor necrosis factor and the interleukins. All of those chemicals and all that alphabet soup that you probably read about when we were trying to understand how COVID caused such serious inflammation in individuals. So here's another one of those beautiful feedback loops. The more inflammation there is in the brain at any given moment, the more the microglia will produce extra CB2 receptors and put them on the surface of their dendrites so that they can be what we call down-regulated to reduce the production of these inflammatory chemicals by the microglia. So it's effectively a calm down command to the immune system when you hit the CBD receptor with something that will attach to it, whether that is an endogenous or an external substance from plants, or chemistry for that matter, as there are a lot of synthetic cannabinoids out there that are getting a lot of buzz in the research. Now, the endocannabinoids have some interesting properties that make them different from most neurotransmitters. In general, things like serotonin, dopamine, and noradrenaline, or norepinephrine, are created in the cell body and then stored in tiny little Ziploc baggies called vesicles. When the impulse comes down the axon, these vesicles fuse with the cell wall and release their contents. It's actually very similar to the way a mast cell releases histamine, causing you to have a runny nose when you encounter an allergen. But in this case, the neurotransmitter is traveling to a receptor across the synapse to send a message. In the case of the cannabinoids, however, they are not made in vesicles and stored. They are, in fact, squeezed out of the cell wall itself very rapidly in response to the axonal signal. But here's what's different about the cannabinoids. A lot of the time, they are actually released at the dendrite end of the cell. They're released in response to having received a message. Effectively, the cannabinoids are released when a cell is saying, "Enough already, I get the point," and asking or seeking to inhibit the cell that is stimulating it, a direct feedback loop, and very elegant. Also, because these are made from the raw materials of the cell wall itself, there is an endless supply of cannabinoids to feed back on the sending cell. You never run into a problem with having emptied all your vesicles and not being able to generate more. So it really is central to the modulating effects of the neurotransmitters on themselves. Another interesting fact about the cannabinoids is how briefly they are present at the synapse. They're broken down very, very rapidly. This is quite different than some of the other neurotransmitters, and it's part of what allows for the dampening effect, which keeps things from spiraling out of control. We'll be talking about that in our first story. But we need to spend just a little bit of time on the names of those endogenous endocannabinoids. The two most common ones are anandamide and 2-AG. I won't go into the chemical names, but you want to look for arachidonic or arachido, A-R-A-C-H-I-D-O, in those names. And of course, arachnid is the word for spider web. So isn't it interesting that I chose a spider metaphor here? And here they are, the Latin name of spiders, showing up in the chemical name of the endogenous cannabinoids. That's pretty cool. And I just this moment thought of it. Once the endocannabinoids are released, they're broken down rapidly by enzymes. We won't worry about the names of those enzymes, but suffice to say that chasing after those enzymes with drugs that might change their activity and make the endocannabinoids hang around a little bit longer is definitely a playground that the biochemical synthetic people at the pharmaceutical companies are looking into. Because what good is a chemical substance if you can't patent it, right? So let's move on to the naturally occurring chemical substances. Some of you may have a nodding acquaintance to tetrahydrocannabinol or to cannabidiol, CBD. These compounds act in very, very different ways. Let's start with good old THC. This compound produces euphoria and a sense of, at higher doses at least, intoxication, the so-called high. And over the last several decades, we've been selectively breeding for stronger and stronger amounts of THC in marijuana, quite successfully, I might add. The average THC content in marijuana in 1995 was 4%. Well, in 2017, it was up to 17%. Who knows where it is today? And that's not even mentioning the various distillation and other concentration technologies which exist to deliver a ever more stronger and powerful boost to the cells. Of course, the cells fight back and adapt by changing the receptors, particularly the CB1 and CB2 receptors, which are the ones we know the most about. A fun fact is that there are other receptors in the brain that respond to plant cannabinoids, but they are primarily able to receive signals from cannabidiol or CBD, not THC. More about that in a minute. The other interesting thing about CBD is that it actually doesn't have a very strong impact in causing the CB1 or the CB2 receptors to fire off. You heard of the GABA receptor, I think, by now. That's the receptor that senses Valium, Ativan, and Xanax. Well, that receptor is also able to sense CBD and responds to it by enhancing a sense of calm and relaxation. The big difference between CBD, THC, and the innate neurotransmitters of the cannabinoid group is that the THC hangs around at the synapse for much, much longer. That makes a big difference in the sorts of effects that you might see, as you can imagine. Unlike with CBD, which does not cause a change in the number of receptors or their probability of response, high dose of THC, particularly if it is regular and daily, and most often in women, will create a withdrawal symptom. With the hyper-concentrated forms of pot, a new syndrome is emerging, not just irritability and queasiness, but actually morning vomiting that is relieved by a hot shower. In these situations, it's important to start dose tapering, but that can be difficult. Research is showing that certain agents actually are helpful. Oddly enough, an anti-seizure drug, gabapentin, is proving to be helpful for the physical irritation and the nausea. Some antidepressants can actually worsen it, but the insomnia also associated with plant-based cannabinoid withdrawal can be helped by a antidepressant now available generically called mirtazapine or Remeron. This is what I mean when I say that there's a flood of new and interesting research. Finding out that I can help people in this situation with non-controlled substances that I can freely prescribe and that are not expensive makes me much more interested in finding people who are having this problem. Now, regular cannabis intake is required to downregulate the CB1 receptors, but over time they become quite non-responsive, hence the withdrawal symptoms. After about 48 hours of abstinence, the receptors start to return to normal, but it takes 4 weeks to allow everything to get back to where it was or would be expected to be at the baseline neural physiology. Okay, that's my last tidbit before we move into our two articles, the first of which describes how 2AG, the other innate endocannabinoid, works for seizures. Now, let's talk about a seizure. There's about 1% of the population who have epilepsy, and you can think of epilepsy as a sort of toxic brainwave meme going viral. Typically, epileptic seizures begin at a single spot in the brain, often in the temporal lobe, where nerve cells begin firing repeatedly together in synchronization. It's a meme, and it spreads to other neurons. And now that we've talked about the synapse, you can see how drifting of the neurotransmitter would change the thresholds of adjacent neurons. And eventually, as larger and larger parts of the brain begin to fire in sequence, consciousness is lost. And you see rhythmic movements coming from the rhythmically firing motor cortex. Often, after a seizure, and it's quite typical, people will need 20 or even 30 or 40 minutes to get back to normal, and they'll have very severe cognitive fog. We call that the post-ictal effect. Way back in the day, I was trained that this was due to the depletion of sugar and glucose in the brain, leading to declined functioning. But actually, 2AG plays a major role. Endocannabinoids, as I said before, inhibit excessive excitement in the brain. So what happens in the case of a seizure is that the neurons, and remember, this is coming from the cell wall, so they can rapidly upregulate and release large quantities of 2AG. About 200 or 300 times as much 2AG is released when a mouse is having a seizure. This surge downregulates and damps down the excitatory neurons and helps lead to the termination of the seizure. You can see how drugs that might act in that same way could potentially help mitigate or modulate the number of seizures that people have. And if we can do that in a way that doesn't act to downregulate the CB1 receptor, we may have a whole new host of anti-seizure drugs coming down the pipeline. Our other story on this topic tonight is about Alzheimer's disease. As many of you know, the hallmark of Alzheimer's disease is the accumulation of beta-amyloid plaques in the brain, particularly in the memory centers of the hypothalamus. There's also phosphorus studying something called tau protein, leading to the intraneural formation of something called neurofibrillary tangles. This disruption in the cell cytoskeleton of neurons eventually leads to their demise, and as you might expect, as you lose brain cells, you lose brain power. It's a little bit counterintuitive, because THC has been shown to have a harmful effect in adolescents with developing brains. Actually, even post-adolescent, most of us don't have a fully formed brain until our mid-20s. However, recent research is showing that as we get older, THC may be extremely beneficial in the prevention of amyloid beta plaque accumulation in the brain. Many studies done in animal models of Alzheimer's, and I want to emphasize these animals are designed to accumulate amyloid beta, whereas the vast majority, 95% of people with Alzheimer's have age-related disease, and their amyloid genes are just fine. So you can make the argument that maybe research in the mice doesn't necessarily apply to humans for that reason. But we have other evidence showing THC to be beneficial. There are a number of drugs out there currently that act as acetylcholinesterase inhibitors. You may be familiar with some of them. Aricept, donepezil, Cognex, and Exelon all act by inhibiting the enzyme that breaks down acetylcholinesterase. Raising levels in the synapse leads to better memory and memory retention, as well as recall. Fun fact, acetylcholinesterase inhibitors are also a major component of certain insecticides that are used in agricultural product, and poisoning by high levels of these compounds leads to a sort of Jimson weed-like syndrome, the classic being hot as hell, that is to say feverish, dry as a bone, that is to say dehydrated, and mad as a hatter, that is to say most definitely wigged out. I don't recommend the recreational use of pesticides for anyone. But other research has shown that THC actually upregulates one of the main compounds that breaks down amyloid beta, thus suggesting that we might be able to find a sweet spot where THC and CBD could both reduce inflammation and also increase breakdown of the amyloid plaque. Now, as I said earlier, what good is a chemical if you can't patent it? So a great deal of money is being spent doing research on the synthetic marijuana drugs, most of which were created to try to treat the nausea associated with chemotherapy and cachexia, or extreme weight loss, also seen in cancer. Another promising bit of research shows that ligands for the CB2 receptor also have the potential to be quite beneficial. It turns out that bone-derived neurotrophic factor, one of the compounds that we know encourages the growth of new synapses, is in fact stimulated by THC. And the neurofibrillary tangles that I talked about earlier, which are studded with phosphorus, CBD seems to inhibit that phosphorylation and therefore could also be a preservative. I'm not going to spend any time talking about the drugs in development to inhibit the breakdown of the endocannabinoids because that research is still in its infancy and there's really not much to talk about at this point. But I anticipate that we will be looking at using both the plant botanical cannabinoids, the modulators of endocannabinoid breakdown, and perhaps other undreamed of at this point strategies to incorporate these natural medicines, as well as their synthetic analogs, into a true neuropreservation pharmacology. And before we go to the break, I want to just give you one more bit of information about another neurotransmitter that could be very important, and that's histamine. Now, I didn't really think of histamine as a neurotransmitter, but histamine is definitely pro-inflammatory. And we know that inflammation plays a huge role in depression. So elucidating the mechanism for that is what this latest research from the Imperial College of London is about. And what they found out was that histamine interacts with serotonin. It reduces the amount of serotonin that's being released in the brain. So it makes you feel bad because serotonin is one of the feel-good hormones. Researchers looked at using lipopolysaccharide, which is a compound found in bacterial cell walls. And of course, since it's mice, they could inject it into the mice brain and measure the inflammation. They found histamine was triggered by the LPS and that it directly inhibited the release of serotonin by attaching to inhibitory receptors on the serotonin neurons. So the neurons released less serotonin if histamine was present. Then they gave SSRIs like Prozac to the mice, but the control mice, the serotonin levels came right up. But in the mice that had the inflammation, they weren't able to boost their serotonin levels. It turns out that SSRIs actually make matters worse. They increase the amount of histamine in the brain, and so they cancel out the serotonin boosting action. So basically, there's going to be, coming out of this histamine research, I think, real possibilities for the management of treatment-resistant depression, because only somewhere between 60 and 75% of people respond to our drugs. So we need other strategies for that group. Going to emails now. Our first email is from Francis in Los Angeles, and it's very terse. Francis writes, "Sudden loss of memory, I have Parkinson's disease." So Francis, I'm just going to say that one of the features of Parkinson's disease are these sudden failures of brain function. This may be very temporary. It's sort of like things go offline and then they come back online. This is a very differentiating property of Parkinson's. There are some other things to be watching for, and one of them is if you start seeing things. And definitely if you start seeing, having visual imagery that isn't agreed upon by the people surrounding you, then that should prompt a visit to your neurologist right away. Otherwise, I would say sit tight. There's a good chance that this may go away. Parkinson's disease, like Alzheimer's disease that I was talking about just a moment ago, are related to the deposition of certain proteins in the brain. And we actually have an article coming up about that a little later in the program, or we may get to that next week. I'm not really sure how we're going to roll here. Our next email from Cannon in Santa Cruz. I'm taking 300 milligrams of strontium citrate complex daily along with 300 milligrams of Ipraflavone, prescribed by an oncological nutritionist following treatment for breast cancer 8 years ago. Heard your show and I'm wondering if strontium citrate has the same problems as strontium ranelate. To the date my nutritionist sent seems out of date, 2008. Hard for me to understand. Thanks for your great show. Well, Cannon, the data's in on strontium, and I think we can say, after I did another search on this particular type of strontium, strontium citrate, which is available in the United States, that it's going to have the same effect on your bone scan report as the regular strontium. And it's basically a Trojan horse effect. So it's going to look good, but it's actually not going to provide you with any benefit. The effect of strontium is to change the ability of the bone scan to predict your risk for fracture, because it makes the bones more dense for the bone scan, but that's a phenomenon where you're running x-rays through the bones. It doesn't tell you about bone stability. And what we now know is that the bones are going to fracture at the risk that they're going to fracture. And when we have a set of bone that doesn't have strontium in it, we kind of know what the risks are because we have large studies quantifying that risk over many, many years to develop the information. Once you throw strontium into the mix, you have no idea. So your bone scan may be looking much better, but it may not be protecting you from breaking your hip. So I don't think it's doing you any good. I think you've already got it in your bones if you've been taking it. You don't really tell me how long you've been taking it, but certainly if you've been taking it for the 8 years, continue to do all of the other things you're doing to preserve your bone mass, like regular exercise, maintaining high levels of vitamin D, making sure you have dietary adequacy in calcium and magnesium and vitamin K, particularly important, the vitamin K. Those are things you can and should be doing. But I'd probably say stop the strontium and let it be built out of your bones, because your bones will do recycle constantly and the strontium will get washed out of your bones. And I'm not sure how long that takes, but probably 3 to 5 years. And then you can believe your DEXA again. Now we're going to one from Anonymous in Santa Cruz. Hi, Dr. Dawn. Thanks for your show. Here's my question. My sister said that Israel has, or initially had, the highest or one of the highest vaccine rates, but now has one of the highest rates of new COVID infection, with people who are seriously ill or even high death rates. Because of this, she's wary of the info we're getting about the benefits of being vaccinated. Could you respond to this? All right. Let's talk about Israel first. First of all, I looked up their current data. And this is from a World Health site. 78% of Israelis over 12 are vaccinated. I think we may have gotten to 70% by now on the average in the United States, but we're a long way from 70% in many communities that are currently experiencing. They're shipping patients out of their local hospitals because they don't have room for the patients. So national data can be misleading. In the United States, what we've got is we've got some serious pockets developing where hospital cases are strained. Now, how many cases? They have 650 cases per million people in the last couple of weeks. Half of those cases are in the vaccinated, but Israel does a lot more testing. So more testing equals more cases. And particularly in vaccinated people, the vast majority of whom have no symptoms or symptoms that are impossible to differentiate from a regular coronavirus cold. The vaccinated in Israel have less than 10% the risk of hospitalization as the unvaccinated. So to me, what this means is that vaccines defang COVID. Why do you think we don't have a vaccine for the common cold? Because it's hard and the damn things keep mutating. But the vaccines defang COVID and turn it into a cold or a flu-like illness. And we're not seeing long COVID after vaccinations. And I think that's the most important thing, because that persistent inflammation, including the brain fog that goes around along with it, which, given the topic of the show this week, you can understand that inflammation and the brain are most definitely no bueno. What are we waiting for? What exactly does not compute here? Nobody ever said it was going to keep people from getting COVID. It said it was going to keep people from getting sick, which is exactly what we're seeing. If we get as many people as possible vaccinated as quickly as possible, planet-wide, we shorten the duration of this dance between each variant as it emerges. And sooner or later, something will come out that is as infectious as Delta, but more resistant to our antibodies. That's bound to happen. Every time we let someone get infected, we're throwing the dice, and sooner or later, it's going to come up snake eyes. So we really need to move on this. One last email for today. This one from LJ in New Jersey. LJ writes, young 60-year-old female professional, I would appreciate your thoughts about the common treatments and outcome for lichen sclerosis in postmenopausal women. I was finally properly diagnosed 8 years ago after a positive biopsy. Clobetasol, which is a steroid, and estradiol creams are useful but don't prevent the atrophy and the fusing. Mona Lisa laser therapy has been recommended to restore tissue structure, but that seems a very traumatic approach and not permanent, although not as traumatic as developing cancer. Do you have any recommendations? I sent you a link for the paper I just discovered online. Thanks in advance, and thanks for your very useful podcasts. After listening to you for years, I very much appreciate your no-nonsense and highly educated approach. Signed, Grateful Jersey Girl. Well, folks, let's talk a little bit about this LS or lichen sclerosis. It's a very, very strange disease. And at this point, we're sort of thinking it's an autoimmune type disease, sort of working on the same sort of immune response as rheumatoid arthritis does. And rheumatoid arthritis, if you've ever seen the hands, causes very distorted changes in the anatomy. And that's kind of what the Th1 immune response autoimmune diseases do. They distort the anatomy. They cause scarring. And this is scarring of the anogenital area. The scarring can actually be so severe that the tissue's function is lost, impairing either voiding or evacuation of stool, or very early on, also sexual functioning. It's odd, too, because it's a biphasic disease. You'll see it in younger prepubescent teenagers. So, you know, 11 and 11-year-olds, if you could find a non-pubescent 11-year-old anymore, but that's a different conversation. But the idea is just before puberty really gets rolling, you'll see it happen on the penis, on the scrotum, and of course on the vulva and vaginal areas in the girls. Then it happens again around the 50s and 60s, around the menopausal age. It's almost always the anogenital skin, although you can see it in other areas. This is the thing that LJ referred to in her LS, is that there's an increased risk, about a 4% increased risk. That means you can get skin cancer. A 4% elevated risk does not mean that the risk is 4%, however. It means that the risk is 4% greater than otherwise. So statistically significant, you could argue that clinically, maybe not so much. So I want to calm LJ down a little bit on the cancer risk here. That's maybe not as high a risk as she thinks it is. When you look at these things under a microscope, what you see is scar tissue forming, lots and lots of collagen. Sitting right under that collagen, a whole bunch of lymphocytes, the T-cell lymphocytes, the Th1. So they're attacking something. They're attacking it in a way that causes scar tissue to form. Basically, the chemicals that are being released by the lymphocytes are triggering scar formation. We know that it does run in families. 12% of women who have it will have a female relative who has it. We also know that there are some certain HLA class antigens. These are the antigens that we use for tissue typing for organ transplant. And oddly enough, some of them increase the risk, but at least one of them, DR17, reduces the risk of developing lichen sclerosis. There's also an association, at least in women, with thyroid disease and with autoimmune disease in general, but specifically thyroid disease seems to be a big one. And one could speculate on the reasons for that. But I have some advice for you, LJ, that is very off the wall, and I'm really hoping it helps, and I'm really hoping that you'll get back to us after 6 months or so and tell us that it has. And that's a compound called mupirocin, or Bactroban. This is an antibacterial. It's not expensive, and it has a fairly unusual, unique property in that it reduces the symptoms and the scarring in lichen sclerosis. And we don't know why, but there's data, and I have several patients who, in fact, I learned about this from a patient who learned about it from her dermatologist who specialized in this. And subsequently, I have given this advice to other patients, and they've had good results. So definitely happy to be able to share something so useful with you. This is not expensive, and you can ask for a prescription, and it is not particularly irritating. And so I sincerely hope that you will follow through and get back to us. And I sincerely hope it helps, but please let us know if it doesn't as well. So we've been talking about Alzheimer's disease and things that reduce it, specifically emphasizing CBD, but it turns out that some diabetic drugs also reduce the risk of Alzheimer's. This came as a complete surprise to me. I had not gotten the memo on this. I typically use metformin in people who are pre-diabetic, who have the genetics to develop Alzheimer's over time, because I want to keep their insulin levels down. I want to keep the inflammation in their brain down. But a class of drugs called DIPP4 inhibitors, that's dipeptidyl peptidase 4 inhibitors, also known as gliptins because, you know, even doctors have to give things nicknames. These drugs are used to lower blood sugar, but a recent study showed people who used these drugs had lower levels of amyloid in their brains overall, even in areas of the brain that are associated with Alzheimer's disease. So this study looked at 282 people with an average age of 76 who were followed for 6 years, and all had been diagnosed with either preclinical, early, or probable Alzheimer's. So they were already sick. This wasn't a preventative study. They had probably have the disease. Now, of the group, 70 had diabetes and were being treated with these DIPP4 drugs, and 71 had diabetes, were not being treated with these drugs, and 140 didn't have diabetes. So they matched the ones without diabetes to those with diabetes for other variables like age, sex, and education level. All of them had similar cognitive test scores at the start of the study. The researchers found that people with diabetes who took the DIPP4 drugs had lower average amounts of amyloid plaque in the brain compared to people who did not take the drugs, the diabetics who did not take the drugs, but also the non-diabetics who did not take the drugs. They also tracked mini mental status exams every 12 months on the people, and they saw a decline on the MMSE. You have a total number of 30 points possible. And you may have been asked some of these questions, copying a picture on a piece of paper, having to count backwards from 100 by sevens, which it's a non-trivial task. Try doing it quickly and you'll see what I mean. Anyway, people with diabetes who took the drugs declined 0.87 points. People with diabetes who did not use these specific drugs declined 1.65 points, almost twice as much. And people without diabetes who were not taking the drugs declined 1.48 points. That really is a substantial variance. If this drug somehow interferes with the production of amyloid, maybe we should think about giving it as a neuroprotective to people who are at high risk or who have been diagnosed. This is a preliminary study. It was done in Korea, so we can assume that most of the patients were ethnic Koreans. The names of these drugs, you'll have seen ads, Januvia, Tragenta. These are agents that I see ads for when I'm going through magazines. A lot of them, the ones that they give me free from my doctor's office because, hey, you know, reach the public, right? They're pretty safe drugs, actually. There's no associated hypoglycemia. These drugs only work when you have high blood sugar. If your blood sugar is normal, they don't do anything. So no problems with causing low blood sugar, which, of course, causes brain damage, and a very, very rare risk of pancreatitis. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what happens with these agents and whether or not we're going to have a new surprising anti-Alzheimer's drug based on an already FDA-approved and safety-tested agent. And I decided to keep us on a thread. One more thing that raises your dementia risk is lack of sleep. A new study just published from the University of Paris looked at 8,000 people over 25 years, starting when they were 50 years old. By the end of the study, 521 of the 8,000 had dementia, and most were diagnosed in their 70s. Those who routinely got 6 hours of sleep or less per night had a 30% increase of developing the brain disorder compared to those who typically got 7 or more hours of sleep a night. Now, we think this has to do with the cleaning properties of sleep, where it allows for detoxification and removal of the proteinaceous debris that accumulates. It's very fascinating to think that maybe just getting more sleep or allowing us to have more sleep is going to reduce the risk of dementia. And of course, there are many reasons, particularly the anti-inflammatory effect of sleep, but you can't beat the cognitive effect. I'm going to switch gears and just talk a little bit about tinnitus, because I have a friend who developed tinnitus shortly after he had a vaccination, the Pfizer vaccination for COVID. I thought, well, I'll do a little literature search and see what I find. And I do find some case reports. But before I go any further, I want to tell you, ringing in the ears, right? This happens with inflammation, and it can sometimes be a permanent tinnitus. If you look at people who were sick enough with COVID to be hospitalized, and I have a study here from the International Journal of Audiology, this was a large audiology clinic. They had a bunch of patients. They had 16 cases of people who reported a change in hearing or the development of ringing in the ears after being diagnosed, and they were 87% male, much more common in males in this small study. The self-reported tinnitus, there were 8 cases of that out of the 16. Only one of them had spinning or vertigo. And the, you know, it's happening in COVID. It's happening a lot less frequently after the vaccine, but I think it's both inflammatory process. Here's a study where they looked at the same 30-day time period in 2019, 2020, and 2021. They looked at new onset idiopathic hearing loss. And what they found there was they had an increase in new onset in 2021, almost doubling from the date in 2019. And of course, 2019, nobody's had COVID. Lots of visits. They had 30 patients who had symptoms that exacerbated either hearing loss or tinnitus shortly after COVID vaccination, and about half and half Moderna versus Pfizer. The average time of onset was within 10 days of vaccination. About half of them had tinnitus. About 25% had dizziness or vertigo. So as I put this together, we know a lot about the inflammatory effects. I found one case study where they gave prednisone. They had 3 patients, and one of them wouldn't take the prednisone. 2 of them did. The one who didn't take the prednisone did not experience a resolution in the duration of time that the study was run. The 2 that did got better, and I couldn't really tell what the time frame was in terms of how long after the ringing they took their prednisone. But to anyone who's developed ringing in their ears after the vaccination, you're in the minority, but there may be a connection and you may not have made it because 10 days out, you might have been looking in a different direction. So a short course of steroids might be advisable. Talk to your primary care about it. It depends upon whether you're pre-diabetic. It depends upon what else is going on in your body. But we're still feeling our way here. And if we can reverse some of these symptoms with a short course of prednisone, like 7 to 10 days, about what I might give someone with a bad case of poison oak, it seems reasonable and legitimate that we should try to do so. Obviously, this is speculation on my part. It's based on minimal data. There's no placebo-controlled double-blind trials here. So it's just a suspicion that something that's relatively benign might help. Well, a lot of things that I've talked about today are associated with aging. Inflammation, osteoporosis, neurodegenerative diseases. But what about baldness? Now, that's another condition of aging. And researchers reporting in a journal called ACS Nano have actually come up with a crazy kind of therapy for baldness that works better than the leading treatment, which is, of course, topical minoxidil. Now, this is a study in mice, not in humans. It's one of these fun, weird science things. So they have designed a microneedle patch containing cerium nanoparticles. That's C-E-R-I-U-M. That's an element. I had to go look it up. It's a soft metal that's used in alloys. And the place that you would have seen cerium where you didn't know you saw it was in those old Coleman lantern little net things that you tie onto the end of your lantern. Those contain cerium. I think that's partly what makes it glow. Now, we know that alopecia, particularly androgenic alopecia, male or female pattern baldness, is related to the loss of blood vessels surrounding the hair follicles. The hair follicles just aren't getting enough nutrients. They're not getting cytokines. They're not getting other essential molecules. And we also know there's an accumulation of reactive oxygen species in the scalp. And that seems to be the 1-2 punch, less blood supply and the accumulation of the oxygen species that just delivers the knockout punch to the follicle cells that form and grow new hair. So researchers at this group had already determined that cerium-containing nanoparticles mimic enzymes that remove excess reactive oxygen species, which reduced oxidative stress in several things, Alzheimer's disease, wounds, and liver injuries. So the problem with these is that they're topical. You can get them into cells, but if the cells are in a petri dish, but you can't get them into the body. So they wanted to find a minimally invasive way to deliver these. So they created a moldable patch with a polyethylene glycol lipid compound mixed with hyaluronic acid. So they made this a dissolvable patch. They put the cerium-containing nanoparticles into a mold. And basically, I guess it's like a little hair shirt that is placed on the skin. And they made bald spots in mice using Nair or some other hair removal cream. And then they looked at what's going on in the mice that have this cerium patch. And they found some really interesting stuff. Among other things, faster hair regrowth, earlier pigmentation of the skin, higher levels of a compound that's only found at the very beginning of new hair development, and they found fewer oxidative stress compounds in their skin. The researchers found that the cerium-containing microneedle patches worked better than the topical treatments, and I can totally see, of course, it's going to have to go through some validation for safety, who knows? I could find nothing on the toxicity of cerium, but hey, if somebody comes up with a treatment for baldness that actually works, let's just say they'll be making a lot of trips to the bank if I don't miss my guess. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.